So I'm looking at your article here, and this has been by far the best article that we've come across when studying the history of the SRC. So could you start by telling me about when you came here?
Yeah, I came for the first time in 1975. And at that time, I was actually commuting between New Jersey and Wisconsin because I was with Bell Laboratories in Murray Hill. Mm-hmm. And we started doing experiments at SRC in 1975. And so then I moved actually to Wisconsin as a professor in 1978.
Great. So what were you studying when you came here?
Physics and specifically, we were working primarily on surface science with a specific interest on semiconductor interfaces, like metal semiconductors and semiconductor. And then that evolved into many other areas, but it was the starting point.
Mm-hmm. So when you came here, you were working on Tantalus, right?
Yes.
Okay. Who did you work with when you were here?
We had a team from Bell Labs that essentially the two main people in the team were Jack Rove. So he's the same family name as Ed Rove, but it's nothing to do with him.
Okay.
The name is Jack.
Yeah.
And then myself.
Okay. So you worked primarily as a user at Tantalus, right?
That is correct. That was for the period of 75 to 78. And then as I moved to Wisconsin, as a faculty member, I started to become increasingly involved also in management until I became the associate director for research. Excuse me, the associate director, there was no distinction at that time.
Okay. Can you tell me about the administrative part of your job?
Yeah, this was the period of the crisis for the commissioning of Aladdin. And so there was a major shake-up in the in all the administration of the Synchrotron Radiation Center because the National Science Foundation actually was upset because of the fact that Aladdin was not working.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a number of replacements. For example, there was Dave Huber that became the director of the Synchrotron Radiation Center. Slightly before then, I became the associate director, replacing Dave Lynch, that had been the associate director at interim for a few months. And I was in charge, essentially, of the optics development. That is, I was supervising all the optics. There was a head of the optics group, that was Charlie Pruitt,
mm-hmm.
and it was under my jurisdiction. And I was responsible for the user programs, for example, logistics, allocation, user support, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still a user, of course.
Okay. So what were some things that you did working with the users to help their demands and things like that?
Yeah, first of all, we were trying to preserve the spirit that was started by Ed Rove, that is to keep the formalities of getting into synchrotron radiation and the bureaucracy, if you will, but also the practical complications down to a minimum, to make it possible for younger assistant professors, for junior colleagues to actually have access to a facility,
yeah.
which was not evident in those days, at least. Okay, and so we developed all the bin time allocation process because we could not just rely on the old approach that was essentially, you went to a draw and you made a discussion of a glass of beer and you got bin time, okay? So we were in the process of developing beyond that, but we made an effort to develop a very simple system that made it possible for users to access without complications. And there was the instrumentation part. So we developed some of the new monochromators and the beam lines that were then became standards, like in collaboration with Fred Brown, the Grasshoppers, the toroidal grading monochromator. And I negotiated with Stanford the loan of the first ondulator that was actually commissioned on Aladdin.
I'm looking at your article, and I'm looking at the picture of all of the sign that was on the door with all the different languages. Can you tell me about that story?
Yes. Now, that was still in the Tantalus time, okay? And Tantalus was a rather primitive facility. I mean, you can still see the building, you know, it was not so comfortable. And in particular, you know, there was the bottom part where the storage ring was located, and then there was the control room that was upstairs, okay? And in particular, the heating, when there was a cold Wisconsin winter, was sometimes a problem. That is, you got a decent temperature when you were in the control room, but the men's room tended to be frozen. Okay, and so there was a situation in which, you know, people that were well behaved went to the men's room, and then afterwards they closed the door, and the pipes would freeze and they would burst. Okay, and so somebody just put a sign writing in English that they had to leave the door open in order to avoid this disaster. And then somehow, I don't know why, but there was somebody that decided to translate that, I think it was in German first, okay? Mm-hmm. And it started this sort of competition in which people were translating in all languages and adding remarks and strong words and stuff like that. So then Ed Rome, there was a sense of humor. At a certain point, you had to demonstrate, you know, there was always this question whether, compared to the national laboratories, Wisconsin was just a local kind of facility. And so he wanted to demonstrate it was not a local goal because it was really international. And so he had the idea of adding this thing as a figure for one of the NSF proposals. Mm-hmm. And apparently it worked.
Do you know when this was? When?
I guess it must have been around 1979 or 1980 or something like that.
Okay.
So it was before Aladdin, of course.
Mm-hmm. When I was in my studies of Tantalus, I learned that it really started off as just a basic local facility, and then I was a local facility for graduate students and professors and researchers to come out here. And I'm trying to find a time when it started to become this international hub that it did.
Well, actually, the transformation was pretty fast. You know, the story was that Tantalus actually was not developed to as a synchrotron source. Mm-hmm. There was an idea in those days to get into the competition for a major elementary particle facility, what eventually became Fermilab. Mm-hmm. And there was Illinois, there was time to push for the Illinois site. So the many other universities in the Midwest, they realized that they had a chance only if they could put together a coalition and demonstrate that they could build a machine like that, because storage rings were a novelty at the time. Mm-hmm. We are talking about 1968, okay? And so Tantalus was the product of this demonstration, that is, all this coalition put forces together. The name was MURA, Midwest University Research Association. So they put together all the resources, and they built Tantalus, which was one of the very first storage rings. No one was dreaming about synchrotron radiation in these days. Now, then what happened is that Illinois got Fermilab essentially just through political maneuvering, okay? Mm-hmm. The story was that President Johnson wanted to pass a bill for establishing Russian consulates in the U.S. against having American consulates in Russia. And there was a strong opposition in Congress because everyone was thinking that these were just spy operations, which they probably were anyway. The President Johnson needed to the votes of the Illinois delegation in order to pass the law, and the chip was actually the selection of Fermilab as the site. And then Tantalus became just an obsolete machine because it was a demonstration machine that was not directly useful for high energy physics. And then there was this idea that came of using it for synchrotron radiation. And so in the group, in the very first user group, there was already an international component with a person from Germany and all the others that had rather strong international relations. So the first foreign users came pretty early.
Okay, great. I don't have any more immediate questions, but maybe we could just continue on from when you came here as the faculty or administration when Aladdin was built.
Yes. Now, I came in 1978, so this was before actually Aladdin was decided and much before the construction. Aladdin was eventually commissioned in 1985, if I'm not wrong. And about at the same time, I became the associate director. So I started to become involved in real administration and not just support roles, only about 7 years after I arrived as a faculty member. So I started as an assistant professor in 1968, and then I got my tenure in 1971. And then afterwards, I started also becoming involved in the administration part. Mm-hmm. Aladdin, then, it was started in the early 80s. It was constructed rather smoothly, and then it started giving us trouble because Edrove and company could not inject a stable beam.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you heard the story about why the machine was not working.
Yeah, yes, I have.
Okay, so I will not repeat that.
Can you tell me about the idea and proposals for Aladdin were forming?
They were forming already in the late 70s, essentially because it was quite clear that the number of users was much, much bigger than anyone had predicted,
yeah.
And therefore Tantalus was going into saturation very fast. And so there was a need for a new machine. Furthermore, it was also clear that having higher energy photons was important because one could reach new core levels.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a demand in that direction. And so the two things were put together and led to the proposal for Aladdin. Now, Aladdin was conceived as a rather cheap machine, and this was done essentially by not having a full energy injection, but injecting with a microtron and then ramping up. And there was a complicated operation. It was part of the problems that then plagued the machine. But after the problem was solved, then the machine was wonderful. I mean, it really worked extremely well, and it is, you know, you see that it has a very long lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Great. I was wondering, do you know what beam stacking is?
Beam stacking, yes. I mean, it was in the, as I remember, the jargon of these days was in the injection process. Essentially, they were continuously adding electrons to the beam that was circulating. Now, since the injection did not occur at full energy, in the first process of injection, there was a progressive increase in the beam current, and this was, as I remember, was called stacking.
Hmm.
After they got a reasonable current going around, then the entire energy in the main ring was increased in order to get to the working energy.
Mm-hmm.
After stacking.
Okay. And once Aladdin was up and running, did you continue to be a user?
Oh, yes, indeed. In fact, I was in physically in Wisconsin in 1990, and then I moved to Switzerland in 1990, and I became involved with other synchrotron projects, that is Elettra in Trieste, and then the Swiss Light Source in Villingen, and a few other projects around. But we continue to be users in Wisconsin, basically until 2 years ago. So it was a very long history of using Aladdin.
Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts about the difference between Aladdin and other light sources?
Okay, first of all, in its construction, the machine was cheaper because they had this solution by not using a full energy injector. The second is that Aladdin was a very reliable machine, okay? When you were doing experiments, you could count on the fact that the beam was there when it was promised to be there, and that especially for the users with not so many resources, so they could not afford just keeping a group there and spending for the travel and so on without having results, that was quite important. Now, the third was this flexibility in the use. I mean, the fact that in spite of the bigger machine and many more beam lines and so on, all the bureaucratic process was still kept down to a minimum. It was much more flexible than in other centers. And this made it possible for, as I was saying before, younger faculty members to be present there and be able to use the machine. Okay. I would say these were the most important elements.
All right. Concerning the injection process, when I look at the microtron, the amount of current that's going through the electron is something about 10 amps, and then the total current in Aladdin would be about 260 milliamps. What do you know about the inefficiencies of injection?
That's not my specialty. Sorry, I cannot help you very much. I mean, what I know is that in a phase space, getting electrons from one to the other is not an easy job. Mm-hmm. But as a matter of fact, it's not inefficient with respect to other processes. So it is just the general condition of the injection process.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of current, is 280 milliamps enough, or do users usually prefer more?
It was actually a pretty good performance, you know, because the struggle in order to increase the current was the entire history of Tantalus, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When Tantalus started, we were talking about currents that were extremely small, microamps and stuff like that. And so I remember when we first reached the milliamp level, okay, and that changed the situation completely because there were new experiments that would have been impossible with the lower intensity. They all suddenly became possible. For example, for the emission spectroscopy, that was the major change. But even with that in Tantalus, having a few milliamps was a major enterprise. Okay, and so when we started getting to the hundreds of milliamps, it was a dream. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So it was really a big, big intensity that no one had expected, really. And after that, I mean, there are some machines that are getting to the 1,000 milliamps, the amps level, and that's about it. I mean, it's not that after Aladdin there was another order of magnitude or something like that of improvement in the current. There was about the saturation of the process in increasing the current.
Mm-hmm. That reminds, were you around when Tantalus switched from its first injector, the FFAG, to the microtron?
No, that was before me. Okay.
Okay.
And in fact, you know, it was one of the reasons for Bell Labs started to be interested in using Tantalus, because before then there were calculations of what you can do, and with that kind of currents there was not much you could do. And so only after the new injector came into line, then it was interesting to use Tantalus.
Mm-hmm. Is the microtron design the same in Tantalus as it is in Aladdin?
Yes, indeed. Okay, and you know that Ed Roux was one of the fathers of the microtone concept, so it was really his baby.
I had read that, or I think it was one of, maybe Charlie told me that Ed had saw, he went to a conference and then heard of the microtron idea, and he really liked it, so he tried to build one.
That is correct, right. But at the same time, you know, after he started building, then he made all the improvements and so on, and so when I'm saying he's a father, I think he's legitimate because although the idea, as many other ideas in accelerators have been around, then there was a big gap with respect to the implementation in these particular conditions.
I forgot my next question that was coming up. I'm blanking now.
No problem. Take your time.
Oh, okay. Now I remember. After Tantalus had been up and running for a little while, I'm sure other models for other light sources began starting up. Do you know anything about kind of the historical context of light sources after Tantalus?
Yes. Well, basically, I think it's the important point was actually before Tantalus, because synchrotron radiation was literally started with synchrotrons. And I worked with one when I was in Frascati, Italy, at the Frascati National Laboratory. Now, the big difference between a storage ring like Tantalus and a synchrotron was the fact that a synchrotron is a pulse machine in the sense that you send a beam, the beam only goes around once, then it dies, and then you have to re-inject, re-send around, and so on. Now, with a machine like that, first of all, you have a tremendous noise problem in the electronics because there are these bangs of the entire electronics any time there is a beam going around. The stability you can forget about because each time you shoot, it goes in a different direction. And the alignments for optical experiments were extremely complicated because the pulses sent around all sorts of dangerous radiation. So you could not actually work close to the beam. You had to stay very far. So for each alignment, you had to wait until a series of injections that took several hours. So you can imagine it was a nightmare because you move the sample a little bit, then you had to wait for 8 hours, and then you were readmitted because the injection stopped, then you could move around again. So the experiment was extremely difficult. Then Tantalus was the first storage ring to be used for synchrotron radiation, and the station was a dream because there was continuous, there was no dangerous radiation, you could work close to the experimental chamber and so on. So after that, basically, there was no contest anymore. I mean, everyone wanted to go for storage rings. Synchrotrons became instantaneously obsolete, and all the game was to design new storage rings and to optimize them in order to emit more light, more intensity, more brightness, and so on. So, only many years later then there was this move to free electron lasers, but it was a long, long time after that.
So we can consider Tantalus to be the first dedicated storage ring, not synchrotron.
That is correct. First dedicated storage ring, and it was the model because it essentially demonstrated that you can run experiments in synchrotron radiation like in a lab rather than in a miserable way like in a synchrotron.
Now, in context of that, what is a betatron?
A betatron is a completely different kind of machine. I don't know very much about them, so I will not be able to give you details about the operation.
Okay. in the histories that I've read that they said that the Betatron was a little bit of a predecessor, or at least the ideas of acceleration were kind of the predecessors to...
Yes, indeed. It was the essentially the precursor of the synchrotrons. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking back to the Mirror days before Tantalus had formed, and I know that you weren't there yet, but do you know about the when Mirror was formed, they were working on three different models of accelerators?
No, I'm afraid I don't. I mean, all I know about the Mirror time was reported later by Edrov and by other people, other users, but that was much before my time.
Okay.
You may ask David Lynch about that.
Okay. Yeah, I will, actually. And maybe going back to Aladdin and when you're working, what else were you involved in? You said you were...
You mean from the point of view of research?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, then, first of all, there was, for the mission, there was the experimental method that we use very widely in order to study surface interfaces. Then, later on, there was a collaboration, again, with Bell Labs, Norman Tolk, primarily, and Mortraum, on photostimulated desorption, that is, sending photons into a surface and forcing the desorption of molecules or atoms and stuff like that, and then analyzing what was coming out. Now, there was an experiment that actually was proposed by Norman Tolk, and Mortraum and I became involved in implementing the experiment together with him, and no one believed, actually, including ourselves, that it would work, because we thought that the signal was extremely small, and so, but in the end, actually, you were surprised, because what we did was to measure and to detect the desorbed species from the photons they were emitting. And believe it or not, you could see them with your naked eye. Hmm. So the signal was much bigger than we expected. Hmm. So that became another line of research. Okay, but the most important was still spectroscopy.
Mm-hmm. And were you working on research up until 1990 when you left?
Yes, indeed. In the last years before I left, the interest switched for the mission from surfaces and interfaces into superconductors. Because, you know, these were the years right after the discovery of high-temperature superconductivity by Bernhardt and Müller here in Switzerland. And so there were early attempts to try to use for the mission in order to study superconductivity, which in those days most people considered as a crazy idea because of the quality of the samples. Mm-hmm. And then since the experiment started to work, then there was a major shift of many experimental groups in that direction.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering now, with the new designs for free electron lasers and things like that, do you think that Aladdin is becoming obsolete?
I don't think so, because you see, the two kinds of machines are really complementary in a sense that in one case, you bring a lot of power into a very short pulse, and in the other case, you have a more almost continuous kind of operation. Mm-hmm. Now, it's very much like lasers. I mean, you have DC and AC lasers, and it's not that when one comes online, then you eliminate the other. There is also a more practical issue, that is, a free electron laser is not a strongly parallel machine, okay? And so you're only going to accommodate a small number of experiments compared mm-hmm. to a storage ring, which means that practically the cost per experiment is much higher. Mm-hmm. So you must be able to justify that you need a machine like that at that cost for the experiment, and this is going to be reserved only for a subclass of the experiments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's all the questions I have for now. Is there any last comments you'd like to say about the SSRC as a whole?
Sure. I mean, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, we all like to remember Ed Rowe, and I think it's fair to say that whatever happened in those days was primarily because of him. Okay, Ed was a difficult character. He was a great friend, but above all, was the man that actually had the courage to think about synchrotron radiation at a time when no one believed that there would be users interested in using in the numbers that we have today. Okay. Now the second, if you want to have a little bit of humor besides this, you know that there was a time when there was this struggle in order to get Aladdin working, okay? Mm-hmm. And so eventually the solution was found in using the sweeping electrodes in order to eliminate the ions that were trapped in the beam. And so there was in those days a faculty member in Wisconsin, Dan Kirst. It was actually the guy that developed the Bevatron. Mm-hmm. And Ed Rowe asked Dan, I mean, Dan was much older than Ed, but Ed was not a very young person, okay? And so he asked whether he could have some suggestions. And Dan expressed all his distaste for all the computer calculations about beams and beam trajectories and so on. And he told Ed to forget about all the simulations and just try with the sweeping electrodes, which was the solution. And then in order to better express what he thought about how you should build an electron accelerator, he came with a sentence that I always liked very much, saying that, young man, if you want to build an electron accelerator, you got to think like an electron. So that was really the symbol of that older generation at the time. Now, do you know about the ladies' room crisis?
No, I don't know.
Okay, no, that in the early days, Tantalum was a strictly men's club because there were no female scientists. And then suddenly there was the first one that came. It was Helen Farrell, also from Bell Labs, okay? And so she arrived, everyone was happy, but then we realized that we only had men's rooms and we didn't have a ladies' room. And so there were only two in the entire facility, and the one downstairs was not available when there was injection, so no one knew how to solve the problem until somebody came with this wonderful idea that it was a double phase sign, so you could just reverse it, and it became men's room or ladies' room, depending on who was inside. Now, let me tell you another thing. I think that you got a message that I have some movies, if you're interested.
Yeah, actually.
Okay, so they are not short movies, and so they're some size. And for that, what I did is to post them on my website.
Okay.
Okay. So if you excuse me just a moment, I'm going to give you the address in a moment.
Sure.
Okay. So the other is http
okay.
.com/ sb3 Samuel Bob 3 .epfl .ch.
CH. What was the first part? Past the http?
Past http is column,
yep.
Sorry. /, then SB3, that is Samuel Bob 3,
okay.
Dot E, P as in Paul, F as in Frank, L as in Lucy, dot C as in Charles, H,
all right.
/ GM, that's my initial,
mm-hmm.
Page, all one word, GM page. .html.
HTML.
Right. I don't know if you're in front of a computer and you can try immediately, because I can guide you to where the where you have to click.
Okay. Can I read that back to you? Make sure we have it.
Go ahead.
So it'd be http://sb3.edfl.
No, EPFL.
EB?
P as in Paul. EPFL.
Oh, EP. Great. Okay. .ch/gmpage.
Yes.
.html.
Correct.
Great.
Now, if you're going to the page, then you'll find that on the left there is a picture of mine, then below that there is a number of things that are for download. The files are called SRC1, SRC2, SRC3, and SRC4.
Okay. All right.
Three of them are movies, and one of them is for the 20th anniversary of the inauguration of the center. Another one is for the inauguration of Aladdin. And another one is a propaganda movie that we made about the same time to see what was in contradiction.
Okay, great.
So you can see a lot of the old users and all the staff members.
Wonderful. Well, all right. Well, thank you for your time, Giorgio.
Not at all. Okay, and if you need more, it would be a pleasure.
Yeah,
okay?
I'll be sure to keep in touch and let you know how the project's coming.
Thank you very much, and good luck with it.
Thank
okay?
you. Bye, Giorgio.
Bye.